We are beginning Masechta Sanhedrin in En Yaakov. So the first Mishnah of it, it's actually the first, all the Mishnayos and Perek, this is one of the Masechtas where the printers decided to jam them all together. But anyway, you have the Mishnayos over there describe the different sizes of Bate Dinim that you need for different purposes. You have a Beis Din of 3, of 23, and of 71, and the different kinds of things that can be dealt with by each kind of Beis Din. So the Mishnah says, Sanhedrin Gdola Hoysa Shal Ayin Aleph, the great Sanhedrin was 71 members, the Shoktana, Shokhov Gimel, and then the smaller Sanhedrins that they had, and they had a few in different places in Yerushalayim itself, and they had different ones all around the country, Shokhov Gimel, the number of people on who serve on them is 23. Minayim Gdola Shishal Ayin Aleph, how do we know that the great Sanhedrin consists of 71 members? Shanema, the Pasuk says, Hashem tells Moshe, when you need new Zkenim, Esfali Shivim Ishmi Zikni Yisrael, gather to me 70 of the 70 men of the elders of the Jewish people. And we mean, by elders, we mean the Talmid Chachamim, the ones who are going to be the new Sanhedrin. Or Moshe Al-Gabayin, and then you have Moshe above them, so you have a total of 71. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Shivim, Rabbi Yehuda says it wasn't 71, it was only 70. Moshe himself is not counted for reasons that the Gemara explains, later in the parak. So that's where you got 71. There's various symbolisms in it. There's a piece from Rabbi Yitzchak that of his father that talks about, a number of different symbolisms in it. We know that there's the Shem Ayin Beis, there's the name of Hashem made up of 72 letters, 72 names made of 3 letters each that come from the Sukkim Vayisa Vayova Vayet. The 72nd of them, if you look what the 72 are, the 72nd one is Mem Vav Mem. Mum. And the Pasuk says, Umum Kolach Yofa Rayosi, Hashem says about the Jewish people, you are all beautiful, Umum Ein Bach, and there's no Mum in you. So symbolically, then you have 71 members, and then there's no Mum, because Mum is only going to be number 72. And then Rabbi Levick talks about when Hashem joins together with the Sanhedrin, so in effect you do have 72, and 72 is Gematria Chesed, and their job is Chesed, they're just Gvura within, they're bringing about Chesed into the world in a Gvura dick way, and 71 is also Gematria of Shem Havaya plus Milui Shem Havaya, or Shem Ma, etc., and you have a number of different symbolisms of how we arrive at the number 71. What about how do we know that the small Sanhedrin consists of 23? So Shinema, it's like this. 23 is the smallest Sanhedrin that can deal with Dinin Nefashis. A base Din of 3 can only deal with Dinin Mominus. So Dinin Nefashis, the Pasuk says, about to have a person who's on trial for murder, the Shoftu Eda, the Pasuk says that the Eda should judge him, which Shoftu implies to execute, to decide and execute Mishpat, judgment against him. Then the Pasuk also says, Vihitzilu Eda, the next Pasuk continues, that the Eda should save him. And send them, in that particular case, send them off to the Ir Miklat. So we learn from that, Eda Shefetis for Eda Matzelis. So there has to be, among the Beis Din, there has to be a full Eda that are convicting him, and another Eda that is acquitting him. Harekan Esrim, so far that gives you 20 Dayanim. Where do we get the other three? So first of all, before we get to the other three, first, Minayim La'eda Shehiasara, how do we know the word Eda is defined as 10? Shenema, as the Pasuk said about the 10 bad Meraglim, Ad Mosei La'eda Harazor, Hashem says, how am I going to have to deal with this bad Eda? Yotsu, Yeshua V'Kolev, and Yeshua and Kolev are excluded, because they were the good guys, so therefore that leaves 10 bad ones. From there we see that an Eda is 10. This comes up also that from that we learn by a series of Gzeira Shavas that B'soich B'nei Yisrael, that also when they're in Kedashti, B'soich B'nei Yisrael, also means 10, and from there we learn that a minion consists of 10, and later in the Masechta we'll have about Kiddush Hashem, that the B'fahesia for that purpose is defined as 10, and so on and so forth. Couldn't find a better example. So that's the vote. In other words, we see that even the 10 bad Meraglim, even though they'd spoken out and against Hashem and so on and so forth, nevertheless, they still have, they're still Jews, they still have a Kol Be'asar, Shchinta Shalya, even 10 guys like them, and they're still considered an Eda, and they're still considered the B'Sosh B'nei Yisrael. Yeah.
Yeah, but We don't know if they did tshuva or not.
We can assume maybe that they did tshuva before they died, which in fact, by the way, you have at the end of Megillas Tainis and in Shulchan Aruch and in Orach Chaim, Siman Tov Kuf Pei, it lists a bunch of fast days that Yechidus Segula fast throughout the year, and one of them is on the 7th or the 17th of Elul, different Gersois, because that was the day that the Meraglim died, the 10 bad Meraglim. So yeah, in other words, that's the idea. We can assume they did tshuva before they died, at least when things started happening to them that brought about their deaths with their tongues and the worms and all that, as we know from Rashi. So after all, we have what to mourn for the fact that they died. But yeah, the point is, in other words, that even while they were Rishoyim, Hashem still calls them an Eda, because it's still 10 Jews together, and I call their sort of Shkintasharia. Yeah. Okay. So far, that gives us 20 Dayonim. Now, how do we know to get another three? So it's like this. We have the implication of a pasuk in Mishpatim that says, don't follow the majority to do bad. In other words, to convict a guy. So the implication is that you do follow the majority when it's for the good of the guy who is on trial. Always when you have a majority. So why does the pasuk then have to go on and say in the same pasuk that you should follow the majority? If we can already infer that from earlier in the pasuk, then why does the pasuk have to repeat it? So it means you do follow the majority even when it comes to convicting, but you need a greater majority. When you incline to bad is not the to good is not the same as when you incline to bad. In other words, when you're going to have a majority for bad to convict the guy, it needs to be a larger majority than you do to exonerate him. Therefore, we learn from this. To do for good, to acquit the guy, is enough a majority of one. Now we can't have an even numbered beis din, as the Gemara is going to say in a minute. But the point is, in other words, let's say you have a beis din of 23. If 12 of them vote to exonerate the guy and 11 vote to convict, then we let him go. But to convict him, to go to bat against him, for that, the Torah does say Achrid Am Lahatis. However, since the Pasuk is also saying, see, Achrid Am Lerois, means that to go Lerois, you can't just have a simple majority. You need a super majority. And how much is that super majority? At least two. To incline to ban and to convict the guy, you need to have a majority of two. So far that would give you, now given that we said before, you have to have a full Eda that is looking to exonerate the guy, then that means, in other words, you have to have the possibility of having 10 votes to acquit him, and then you would have 12 votes to convict him. And so far that gives you 22. They're in based in shokel. Now you can't have based in be an even number because they might get deadlocked. What if they split 11-11? Therefore we have to add another one. Harei kan chof gimel. There you reach your number of 23. Now later on the Gemara asks, in that case, if you have a base in Eitz Yosef, brings it over here. Okay, Rashi brings it also, actually. Look, if you can't have an even number based in, then how are you ever going to have a majority of two to convict? It's going to be either a majority of one or a majority of three. You're going to have 13 against 10, or you're going to have 12 versus 11. And the Gemara explains, because you can have a case where among the 23 Dayanim, one of them says, I don't know. I can't decide. I can see this way and that, and I can't decide whether to join those who convict or those who acquit. So now, in effect, we only have 22 dayanim. The din is that in that case, we have to add two more dayanim. That brings us to 24. Now, if the 24 of them deadlock, then you still just have to keep on adding more and more dayanim until you may even reach 71. But if not, if among those 24, 13 say we should convict, and 11 say we should acquit, then we convict him. So there's your majority of two. So therefore, it can be made to work. So not with the original complement of 23, but by subtracting one who doesn't know and then adding another two, or another two after that. If the 24 deadlock 12 and 12, then you'd have to add another. Or if one of them also says, I don't know, then you'd have to add two more dayanim in the Gemara later on, and the Masechta goes on and deals with the details of that. But ultimately, then you can have the number, can be an even number, and then you're able to have your majority of two. Now, by the way, when we're saying that you have to have Ada Marcellus, it doesn't mean in the end that you have to have at least 10 votes to acquit the guy. Suppose, for example, so you have the regular 23 and all of them know one way or the other, and it ends up, let's say, 16 of them vote to convict and 7 to acquit. Fine, we're still going to go and execute the guy. All we mean is there has to have been the possibility that there could be 10 votes to acquit, and there should still be a supermajority to convict. And that requires at least 22, and again, you can't have an even number to begin with, so you have 23.
In fact, you need two more. Does that relate into the Hitzila Ha'eda?
That's the point. No, the point, well, that's the point. Yeah, the Hitzila Ha'eda, in other words, based in a supposed, that's the point. Hashem wants that if you shouldn't be, in order to convict, in order to make it that a fellow Yid is going to have to be executed or whatever, you need a majority, you need a super majority. You need a majority of at least two to do that. A majority of one is not enough. Yeah. So the Gemara starts talking about the various dinim for where the Mishnah had talked about the dinim momentous need a base din of three. And the Gemara starts dealing with the details of what kind of dinim mominus require a base din of three. You have dinim mominus of the more common kinds, like hodois valvoi, the person Reuben lent Shimon money, and now he wants to collect it, or Shimon admits in front of Edom that he owes Reuben money. And then you have the less common kinds of things, which the Mishnah also mentions, gzeilus v'chavolus. Shimon stole money from Reuven, or Shimon injured Reuven, or whatever. So the Gemara starts dealing with the details, which kind need what kind of dayanim. In the course of it, the Gemara mentions the point that on the face of it, you should require smuchim. You should always require dayanim, who have the original smicha, ishmi piyish, back to Moshe Rabbeinu, in order to judge all kinds of cases of dinim ominous. But we don't want to do that, because what happens in a time and place where you don't have smicha, then it would be impossible to judge such things, and it's called shalitino delas b'fnei loivin. We don't want to lock the door in front of borrowers. In other words, we want to make it that people should be willing to lend money. If they know that it's going to be hard for them, that it's going to be extra hard for them to collect, then they may not bother lending in the first place. So in that connection, the Gemara mentions the following point. Amar of Hanina, Dvar Torah, Mina Torah, Echad Dinim Mominus, Echad Dinim Nefoshes, Bidrisha Vachakira. Whether Dinim Mominus or whether Dinim Nefoshes, you would have to do Drisha Vachakira. Later on in the Sechta, that goes into some detail. You have certain chakiras, certain seven basic questions that you have to ask the agent to establish the exact time and place of the event that they're testifying about, which is important in order to make hazoma possible. You have to have the possibility of them being found to be Edom Zomimin, so that requires that we establish exactly when and where their Edos is. So that conceivably, other Edom can come and say, Imonu Hayisem, as we will learn eventually, Best Hashem and Masechta Makkah, it's all about that. Anyway, so that's Chakira, and then you have Drisha, then you have various other detailed questions that you're supposed to ask them as well. So Minatori, you would have to do that, both for Dinin Mominus and for Dinin Nefashis. Shenemar, as the passage says, Mishpat Echad Yelachem, there should be one rule for you. Dinin Mominus and Dinin Nefashis should both be the same thing. And since Drisha v'Chakira is mentioned in connection with Dinin Mominus, Dinin Nefashis, Rashi points out, so Minatora, it applies to Dinin Mominus as well. Uma tam omru Dinin Mominus lebe'in and Drisha v'Chakira, so why by Dinin Mominus? Did the Chum say you don't need Drisha v'Chakira? So the same reason, Kadeshle Tino Delos, Bifnei Loivin, so as not to lock the door in front of borrowers. In other words, the same idea. Nobody, if a person figures, well, in order to collect my money, I may have to take the guy to Beis Din, and then Beis Din is going to cross-examine the Edom in great detail, and they may find some little discrepancy in the testimony of the Edom. Now, you have, when it comes to Dinin Nefashis, for example, they could ask the Edom what color shirt was the guy wearing, and if one of them says black and the other one says white, then we toss out the whole case, even if everything else matches up. So we don't want that kind of thing by dinim mominus, because it's very common. People see things slightly differently or remember things slightly differently or whatever, and then the whole case is going to be thrown out, and the guy's not going to be able to collect his money. So therefore the Chachamim, using their power of Hefker based in Hefker, can say we don't need Dirish of Hakira. In the same vein, then, the Gemara goes on to say, but for the same reason, we don't require Mumchin for basic dinim mominus, such as Hodois Valvois. We don't require a dayonim that have that original smicha ishmi piyish. It's fine to have any dayonim who know their way around halacha. Okay. A couple of blocks later, the Gemara deals with the question, in secular law, you have a concept called judicial immunity sometimes. You know, you have a judge rules on a case, and it turns out that he was mistaken. It was in many cases, he's immune to being put on trial and prosecuted for his mistake. So Lahavdil, in Halacha, you have a similar concept that where sometimes a Dayan is, because he's a Mumcha, or because he has a Rishus from somebody in authority to judge, then therefore he's immune to, if it turns out that he passed in wrongly and he doesn't have to pay, the Gemara goes into various details about it, depends what kind of, among other things, it depends what kind of mistake he made, but it also depends whether he has that Smicha Ishmi Piyish, or whether he has Rishus from the governing authorities. So, the Gemara says, Pshita, now it's obvious the following fact. Mehocha lahocha, from here to here, meaning from within Bavel itself. Now, in Bavel, you have the Resh Galusa. The Resh Galusa was descended ben Achaben from David HaMelech, and he was the governor of the Jews in Bavel. He was basically like the government minister of the Jews. We find in different places in the Gemara that he was considered a very high-level official of the king. He would often appear in front of the king and so forth, and he was descended ben Achaben from David HaMelech, and he had authority in Bavel. Among other things, his authority was that he could give people reshus to, that they could officially function as dayonim and judge cases of dinim mominis. Now, in Bavel, they didn't have smicha. They didn't have the smicha ishmi piyish. It can be given only in Eretz Yisrael, but people would get reshus from the Resh Galusa, and therefore that makes it that now they are the official dayon of this place, and they have the right to summon people in front of them to Beis Din, and also that they have the certain degree of judicial immunity if they make a mistake in certain, in halacha, certain kinds of mistakes. So, mehocha lahocha, it's obvious then that if you have somebody got reshus from the Resh Galusa in Bavel, and he's now here in Bavel, in another city or whatever, so then definitely his reshus is still effective, and he still has that judicial immunity. Or mehosam lahosam, and from there to there, we know it's Yisrael, instead you have the Nesiim. Now, Tosfos points out that the Nesiim were descended from Hillel, Ben Achaben from Hillel, but they were actually descended from David HaMelech only on their mother's side. In fact, there's a Yerushalmi that says that they were actually descended on the father's side from Shevet Binyamin. Yes, Omim, that the Badli disagrees with that. There's a Gemara in Ksubas that seems to imply that Hillel and his family were, in fact, Ben Achaben from David HaMelech as well. But, so another way of looking at it is, as we're going to say now in the Gemara, is that the Rosh Galusa in Bavel had greater power, they were given greater power by the government, compared to the Nesiim in Eretz Yisrael. So now, obviously, now if a person has gotten Rishus from the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael, and he's traveling around in Eretz Yisrael, then his Rishus is effective, and he has the right to force people to come to his Beis Din, and all the other rules that come together with that Rishus. So then Mahani, so it's effective. Or Mehocha Lahosam, now it's also obvious, the Gemara goes on to say, from here to there, if a person gets permission from the Resh Galusa to judge Dine Mominus, and then he travels to Eretz Yisrael, then that Rishus will also be effective for him. Nami Mahani, that will also be effective. And the reason is, the Hocha Shevet V'Hosam Mechoike. Because here, the Rosh Galusa, who are in Bavel, are what's called in the Torah Shevet, which implies, Rashi says, Loshen Srora, they have power, they have government power. They even have permission to be mafkir's people's property. Hefker based in Hefker, the Rosh Galusa had such power. So Vahosam Machoikik, whereas there, the Nesiim in Eretz Yisrael, they were Machoikik, the lawgiver, which implies that they have less governmental and political power. Kedetanya, as we learn in a Braisa. The Pasuk says, Lo Yosef Shevet mi Yehuda. Yaakov gives Yehuda a bracha. The Shevet, which literally means the staff, will not go away from Yehuda. And that means, the Rosh Galusa to Bavel. So that refers to the Rosh Galusa in Bavel, to Roden Es Yisrael B'Shevet, where they can rule over and dominate over the Jewish people with a staff they have. They have this power that was given to them by the Persian kings, and therefore they're called Shevet. The Pasuk continues, Mechokev Min Raglav, and the lawgiver will not go away from between Yehuda's feet. Eilu b'nei bonav shel Hillel, that refers to the descendants of Hillel, the Nesiim in Eretz Yisrael, shem alabdin Torah b'rabim, where they teach Torah in public. Their power derives from the fact that they are the greatest Talmid Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael, and their authority comes from that, but not so much from the authority that the government gives them. They had a certain degree of authority as well. We find there are places where it mentions, for example, a police force that the Nasi had at his disposal, but still they were ruled over by the Romans. It was a different system of government, unlike in Bavel, was ruled over by the Persians, and they didn't give the Nesiim as much power. So according to Rashi, it's just strictly that, the question of how much power they're given by the respective Goyish authorities. According to Tosfos, it's also the consideration that the Rosh Galusa are descended Ben Achaben, in the male line, from David HaMelech, whereas the Nesiim are, whereas in Asiyah, in Eretz Yisrael, are descended only from the mother's side. So Tosfos points out, and Marshall goes into more detail, on the other hand, precisely because we're saying that the Nisim were the greatest Tamil Chachamim, and the Rosh HaGalusa were not. Now, it's going to have individual Rosh HaGalusa were also great Chachamim. We have, for example, there was one of the Amoraim, Rav Huna Bar Nosson, was one of the Rosh HaGalusa as well. So he was a Rosh HaGalusa, and he was one of the top-level Chachamim. We find them in a lot of places in Jas. Many of the other Rosh HaGalusa were not, as opposed to the Nisim, for generations after generation, were the greatest Tamil Chachamim. So in that sense, they have an advantage. But when it comes to, and also you have the point, Avidah Eretz Yisrael Machkin, after all, they become wiser in Torah because of the era of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore they are called Elikim. The Gemara discusses over here that Elikim, besides meaning Hashem, and besides meaning Malachim, another meaning of it is people who have the ultimate authority as Dayanim, namely that they have Smicha Ishmi Piyish. And again, that also, they only had an Eretz Yisrael. So the Rosh HaGalusa, the Nesiim in Eretz Yisrael have all of those advantages. On the other hand, we're saying over here, in terms of being able to give authorization to somebody else to judge Dinim Mominus, in that sense, the Rosh HaGalusa have the greater power. Elikim Lo-Tekel has two meanings. It means don't curse a judge, and it also means don't curse Hashem, yeah. But the word Elikim, for example, in Parshas Mishpatim, you have several times, Adher Elikim Yovid Var Shnehem, the Nikra Balabais Elikim, and then the Gemara explains that any time it says Elikim, in those contexts, it means Dayonim who have Smicha. So in Eretz Yisrael, they had that, and Bavel they didn't, but nevertheless, the Rosh HaGalusa was saying had the advantage in that they were given greater power by the Persians, and in the fact that they were descended Ben Achaben from David HaMelech. In fact, there is yet another Gemara on that subject. There's a Gemara, a relevant Gemara in Herodias, where Rebbe one time asks Reb Chiya, he says, me being the Nossi in Eretz Yisrael, suppose the Beis Mikdash was still standing. Suppose that I were to do an Aveira that requires me to bring a Chatas. Would I have to bring the Chatas of the Nossi? The Torah tells us in Parshas Vayikra that a king brings a special Chatas compared to a regular person. Would I be in that position? And Reb Chiya tells him no, because you have a rival in Bavel. And in fact, as we're saying over here, the Reish Galusa in Bavel has, to a certain extent, a power that is greater than Revi's. So in other words, you're not. In order to bring that special carbon, it would have to be Ein Al Gabav El Hashem Alekav. There's no greater authority among Jewish people than you. Only Hashem is above you, and here with Rebbe and the Reish Galusa, you didn't have that. So the Gemara goes on to talk about what about the other way around. If somebody gets Rishus from the Nossi in Eretz Yisrael, does that give him the right to go judge Dinim Mominus in Bavel? And the Gemara goes and talks about a story involving Rav and Rav Bar Chana in that connection, and a whole long arichus about it. Worth mentioning, by the way, a cute thing that's a Muslim historian during the time of the Gaonim writes that one time he was talking with the Reish Galusa of his times, and the Reish Galusa tells him, I want you to see the difference between us Jews and you Muslims, says the Reish Galusa. By now it's 2,000 years since David HaMelech's times, but still the Jews have tremendous respect for me because I'm descended Ben Achaben from David HaMelech, even though many, many generations have passed since then. He says to this Arab, you guys went and killed the grandsons of your own prophet only a couple of decades after he dropped dead. So you see how much respect you guys have even for very close descendants of your guy. So the Gemara continues in this regard. Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Talmid al yoreh b'mokim rabbi. A Talmid should not decide questions of halacha in the place where his rebbe is. Elen kein hayorochik menos shalosh parsois, unless he's at least three parsa away. Keneged machne Yisrael, which is equal to the size of machne Yisrael. Now Moshe, most of the time, stayed in the middle of the machne. But there was a period of time, we know from Parshas Kisisa, when Moshe yikachas the oil. There was a time when Moshe took his tent after the Chet Ha'egel and pitched it outside the machne. And whenever anybody wanted, v'hoyakom avakash Hashem, anybody who wants to learn Torah, and anybody who had a din Torah, would go michutz la machne to Moshe Rabbeinu. So, and the maximum anyone would have to walk is three parsa, because the machne itself was 3 by 3 parsa. Therefore, you see that if a Talmud is anywhere within 3 parsa of his Rebbe, then he's not allowed to pass in halacha. The Eitz Yosef brings over here a relevant piece from the Rambam that explains that that means we're not even talking about a Talmud. A Talmud does not have the right to set himself up as a permanent Rav or a permanent Dayan as long as his Rebbe is alive, unless his Rebbe gave him Rishus. When we talk about over here the three parsos, we mean on an ad hoc basis, as a one off kind of thing. Now, one other detail, the Gemara does mention that if it's La Frushim Isura, if it's the Talmud sees that somebody else is about to do something that's outright also, then he's allowed to speak up even if the Rebbe is right there. As we say, Ein Chochma, Ein Eitzah, Ein Tzvulim, and the Negen Hashem, there's no, when it comes to Chilul Hashem, when it comes to somebody doing a blatant Avera, we don't give any Ein Chochim Kavod L'Rab. But other than that, it has to have the three parts of the rule. Further on, the Gemara starts talking about the question like this. So people come, you have a din Torah. You have ultimately, a din Torah is going to be one of you is right and one of you is wrong. Pay up or don't pay up, as the case may be. What about the dayan making a pshara? What about making a compromise between the two of them? So the Gemara deals. So the Gemara starts dealing with the matter, and then the Gemara brings Rabbi Eliezer, Bnei Shur, Rabbi Yisak, Rabbi Omer, also live tzoya. First, the Gemara brings opinions that you are allowed to make a compromise like that, and then now Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yisak, says also live tzoya. You're not allowed to make a compromise like that, and that means we're not even talking about. Rashi explains when they first come to the Din Torah. We're not even talking about when the Dayanim have started to look into it and they have a fair idea what the Psak Din should be, and then at that point they're going to make a pshara. There's a different opinion about that in this sugya, Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh, who says that at that point the Dayan is not allowed to. That's what we'll learn about tomorrow, Best Hashem, that you're not allowed to make a pshara. Here, Rabbi Eliezer, the notion of Yisak Levi, is saying just the fact that they came to the Din Torah already, you can't. It is too late to make a pshara. And if a dayan at that point decides to make a compromise, then he's sinning by doing that. No, he has to at that point paskin the answer at that point, deal with it as a regular din Torah, and decide the case. Ian Yaakov points out, in other words, because listen, you make a compromise, ultimately it comes out that somebody is keeping something ill-gotten. And also, one of the three things, al shlosha dvarim olam oimed, al din v'ala emes ala shalom. So look, we know Hashem, Ian Yaakov points out, we know that Hashem created the midas adin, saw that the world is not going to last, and joined with it midas arachmin. But now, if a person is going to make a pshara, then he thinks that he's thinking, that Hashem started out with Rachamim, and it's not so. Hashem started out with Din, and it means there's rules. You have there's mitzvahs and there's averus, and you can't play around with that. So if a person is going to start thinking you can make a pshara, then he's apt to think that Hashem created that world in that way in the first place. That fine, Hashem will go easy on, and Hashem is going to make psharas when it comes to people's averus, and that's not so. So we have a few different opinions in the sugya over here. Rabbi Eliezer Bnei Shur Rabbi Yisak Levi is saying once they came to the Din Torah, then it's too late. You want to make a pshara, as we're going to see soon about Aaron, it has to be before it came to a Din Torah. I mean, obviously, if the two people themselves want to make a pshara, that's a whole other matter. But we're talking about for the dayan to say let's make a pshara and impose it on you. Yeah. And in fact, anybody who compliments and blesses somebody who makes a compromise like that, hareis minayis, then he's angering Hashem, because Hashem doesn't want that kind of thing. Hashem wants that the dayanim should judge the din the right way. Val zenema, this is the pasuk says, and kill him, over itseya beirech niyetz Hashem. The one who blesses the Beit Seah is angering Hashem. We're going to see soon a few different explanations of this pasuk, but this is Rabbi Eliezer Ben Yosher Rabbi Yisak Levi's explanation that Beit Seah, when you have somebody who makes a compromise, but the word batza, among other things, needs to cut, like the tzias apas. So to make a pshara is like cutting, like splitting splitting the difference. So therefore, the word Beit Seah would mean with that. Beirich, somebody who blesses him, nietz Hashem, is angering and reviling Hashem by doing that. Ella, no, says Rabbi Eliezer, Yikav Adin Esahor. The din has to pierce the mountain, which means the Marsha refers to the Aruch. Gives two explanations. One is it means, exactly that. In other words, you may think it's very, very hard to do, as if it involves like tunneling through a mountain. Nevertheless, if that's what the din requires, do that. The other explanation, the Aruch says, is the word Yikov can also mean Meloshin to express something clearly, like V'nokev Shem Hashem. So in that case, it means the Dayan, the Har, which is to say the Dayan, has to be Yikov, he has to state outright what the din is and not play around and not make compromises. Marsha points another point as well. The Dayan, why would a Dayan want to make a pshara? One reason might be because one of the Bali Dinim is a tough guy, and he's concerned that if he ends up judging that the guy has to pay or whatever, then that guy is going to start harassing the Dayan. So nevertheless, so that guy may be a har, he may be a mountain. So here, the Oroch second explanation is taking the mountain to refer to the Dayan. Marsha says the mountain can refer to the Bal Din Kosher. Nevertheless, Yukabadin, nevertheless, you have to pierce through. You gotta do what needs to be done and not be afraid of this Baldin. Like the Guru Mepneish. Shanema, as the Pasuk says, Kiya Mishpat Levikim Hu, the judgment is Hashem's. So therefore, you can't play around with it. V'chein Moshe, ha yo'omer, Yukabadin Sahar. Moshe Rabbeinu would express himself that way, Yukabadin Sahar. We're not making any compromises. This is the din. Take whether you like it or not. Aaron had a different way of doing it. Oyev Shalom, the road of Shalom. Aaron loved peace and pursued peace. Or Mason Shalom on a machabeira, and he made peace between one person and another. So Rashi explains what it means is when Aaron would hear that two people are having a quarrel before they would ever come to a din Torah, he would be roidif, literally, he would run after them in order to make shalom between them and make a compromise. And that's fine, because Rabbi Yezir is saying, when they come to Beis Din, you can't. But here, Aaron would proactively, before they ever come to Beis Din, he would work to make a compromise between them. Tosfos has a different explanation. Look, Aaron is not a Dayan in the fruit, and Aaron is not a Dayan at all. Okay, we find by Matan Torah when Moshe goes up to Har Sinai, he says, Aaron v'chori mochem, and there'll be the Dayanim while I'm away. But apparently Tosfos is explaining that Aaron didn't serve as a Dayan on a day-to-day basis. So therefore, he has the ability to be Oyev Shalom, Oyev Shalom, and make that compromise. So now Marsha says why the triple expression Oyev Shalom, Veroyev Shalom, or Mesim Shalom is because you have we have three kinds of Shalom. There's Shalom between a person and Hashem. There's Shalom between a person and himself, that a person himself should feel at peace. And there's Shalom between a person and another Ben Adam Machaveri. So now Aaron would work all those three things. If he makes a pshara at the appropriate time, he's bringing shalom between the people and Hashem, because, again, the mishpat is Hashem, so this is, and after all, the Gemara points out later, if a dayan mistakenly or on purpose or whatever causes, declares what's supposed to be the innocent party to be guilty and makes him pay money, then Hashem is gonna have to reimburse the wronged party, and therefore the dayan is causing causing Hashem a financial loss. So therefore, if you make a pshara, then you avoid that whole thing. So therefore, it brings shalom between the people and Hashem. So that's Oyev Shalom. The Roid of Shalom is that, like this you have, Marsha explains, you decide a judgment, you decide a verdict. What happened? The guilty party may run away rather than complying with it. And then he's going to hate the dying. Whereas you make a pshara, then fakir, it pursues peace, you'll have peace with the guy, he's not going to run away and he won't be the dying's enemy. And Mason Shalomin on a Machaveiro means between the Baal Ejin and themselves because they both agree to the Pshara. As opposed to when you have an actual Din Torah, even one of them wins, one loses, fine, the one who loses accepts the verdict, but he still kind of bears a grudge in his heart maybe, and maybe after all it was wrong and whatever, I didn't really owe that money. Whereas when you have a Pshara, you avoid all of that. So that was Aaron's style. There was a sicha, an interesting sicha, where the Rebbe talks about at the end of the Torah, we have at the end of the Zos HaBracha, we have where it says that they mourn Vayivku Bnei Yisrael as Moshe Shloshim Yoim. And Rashi explains that Bnei Yisrael means only the men, whereas by Aaron HaKohen, when he passed away, it says Kol Beis Yisrael, the entire Jewish people, men and women and children. So why is that? Because Aaron was, as we're saying over here, was Oyev Shalom, Oyev Shalom, etc., whereas Moshe was Yikav Adina Sahur. It's an interesting sikha, but it never talks about at the end of Moshe's life is the time to mention that as like a derogatory thing against Moshe that he wasn't of the caliber of Aaron. So if I care, what it means is Moshe had to be this way. He had to be Yikav Adina Sahur because Moshe has to be purely Midas Emes. He's the one who brought us the Torah, and therefore he can only go with the Emes and no Psharis. Whereas Aaron is able, as we're saying, because he wasn't a Dayan, or he's not a Dayan yet, or whatever, so he's able to. So now, Moshe himself, at the end of his life, is able to think back and see, that's true. I had my Derech and Avodah, and Aaron had his, but in a way, I have what to regret, that I wasn't able to take on his method of avoida. I wasn't able to because of my position, but it's still like Moshe himself can be thinking about that and could I have done differently? And therefore the Torah highlights it over there that this is Moshe himself realizing it for himself of the contrast, comparing and contrasting what I was versus what Aaron was.
If the people came to Aaron as a Dayan.
If they came to him as a Dayan, then as Tosfos says, yeah, you'd have, again, he can't make a pshara either, yeah. Okay. So Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, as a praise to Aaron, these psukim are in Malachi, and before that it's talking about the Koyanim, that the Koyanim have to follow in the ways of Aaron, and then the Pasuk describes what was Aaron like. In fact, Medrash says the following Pasuk that the Gemara is going to quote was actually the hesped that the Eibush just said and that the Malachim said when Aaron passed away. The Torah of truth was in his mouth, and there was never anything unjust found on his lips. The shalom of Mishra Holachiti, he went with me in peace and in uprightness. The Rabbim Heshid Me'oven, and he brought back many from doing Averis. Because we're saying that Aaron was Oyev Shalom, Veroyev Shalom. And he accomplished all these things. He brought about. He's kept many people away from Averis. We know the famous thing when two people are arguing that Aaron would go to one of them and tell them that your friend feels bad, and they'd go to the other one and tell them your friends feel bad, and then they make shalom. And similarly, you make shalom ben ish to ishtoi, and other things like that. Radam Meheshim Me'oven. Also, the Medrash says Aaron would go and greet everybody in the street in a very friendly way. And later on, if the guy is about to do an Avera or has previously done an Avera, he would think to himself, is it worthy that Aaron spoke to me in such a friendly, kind way, and I should go do this Aveira? And that itself would dissuade the guy from doing the Aveira. So that's also Radabim Heshiv Me'ovin. And people named a lot of their kids Aaron after him. Whenever he made Sholem Ben Ishtoi and kept marriages together, they would name their kids after him, etc. Yeah. So Maharsho explains also that you have the whole pasuk over here. He explains that don't think, for example, that you can have a dayan who doesn't really know the din, and therefore he has no choice but to make a pshara because he doesn't know what the din should be. Then you can have that maybe he doesn't know how to speak it out properly, or he might say it in a way that's ambiguous, and they might misunderstand him. As we have in Pirkei Avos, after all, because people might misunderstand them, etc. So now the Pasuk is saying that Aaron didn't have any of these things. Not because he didn't know, because Torah emes hoseh b'fihu, he knew the Torah of truth, the Torah that Moshe had taught. Avlal in into the sfasav, he knew how to be careful and not say things in a way shem metelchem yumin ulashaker. And the reason is because the shalom of Misha holachiti, that he went in a way of peace and of uprightness. That he's doing in a way that should be as fair as possible to both of them. And Rabim Heshed Me'oven, and with that he brought back many people from Averis because, like this, in other words, if again, a Dayan may make a mistake in Halacha and cause that a person is unjustly receiving money that shouldn't belong to him, or other things like that, and then it would be considered an Avera, whereas when he makes a Pshara, then you don't have that, then after all, Pshara is Mechila. And therefore we're all good, and therefore he's bringing many people away from Avera. So all of that is another meaning of this possible. So that's the contrast then. So Rabbi Eliezer is saying that a Dayan should not make a Pshara, and if he is, then that's Britzeya, and if a person compliments him, that he's Britzeya Berach, Niyat Hashem, whereas Aaron avoided the whole thing in the first place by putting himself in a position where he could make a Pshara without it being a problem. The Gemara continues, Rabbi Eliezer, now regular Rabbi Eliezer is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus. Before we had Rabbi Eliezer ben Oshur, Rabbi Yitzhak Levi, here we have Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus. Oimer, he says a different explanation of the Pasuk, Ritzei Beirach Nietz Hashem. Areshe Gozal Sa Shochitim. Suppose a person stole a saw of wheat, the Tochna, and he ground it up, Va'afa, and he baked it, the Hifrish Memen Chala, and he took Chala off it. Tosfos points out that sometimes, now usually when you take challah when it's still dough, but sometimes you have certain kinds of baked goods where the halacha is they don't become in chayiv and challah until they're baked. To make a long story short, there are dinim involved, but basically where you were going to, where you made a batter and you could fry them like pancakes, and then you could choose instead to bake it like cake. And then only when you bake it into a cake, then it becomes chayiv and challah, which is why the Gemara is using the expression afal. Anyway, the Hifrish Men of Chala, if now this guy takes Chala from it, Ketzad Mavarech, how could he possibly be making a bracha, Asher Kedushanam Mitzvah Sivitivanu, Lahafrish Chala? Ains and Mavarech, Elamanoit, such a person is not blessing Hashem, Elamanoit, he's angering and reviling Hashem. And this, as Rabbi Eliezer says, is what the pasuk means. In other words, he doesn't understand, like Rabbi Eliezer ben Eshra, Rabbi Yosef HaGlili, that Beirach means the person who compliments and blesses the Beit Seah. Rather, he learns the pasuk is Beit Seah, the one who steals. So the Mabetza, as the Gemara is going to mention next about Yehuda, that the word Betza, among other things, means stealing. So, over it, Seah, the thief, Beirach, who blesses Nietz Hashem, is actually angering Hashem, which is not really something Hashem doesn't want, that kind of bracha, on a mitzvah bar baver. From this we have a halacha that comes out in halachas of brachas. If a person eats something treif or something stolen or whatever, should he be making brachas on it or not? So should he not be making a bracha on the grounds that we're saying over here? And you have the question as far as a bracha rishona. After all, you're also not allowed to have anah from this world without a bracha rishona. So it ends up being a machlokas a poskim whether in fact he should make a bracha on it or not, if it's non-kosher food or stolen food or what have you. So the result is that, in general we say sofek brachas lahakol, so the result would be that Itaka doesn't make a bracha. Okay, so that's Hashem. We'll continue tomorrow with more explanations of Ritzia Berach Nietz Hashem. Yeah. Yom Yom Mashiach Lola, Gimel Eir. The Rambam brings in Yad HaChazaka about the Ore Miklat, that the in Yad HaVashem Alekechaz Gvulcha, if Hashem will expand your borders, then you have to add three more Ore Miklat, and the Rambam points out, we never had such a thing. The borders of Eretz Yisrael were never expanded to the point where we need those extra three cities, and since Hashem wouldn't have given a mitzvah for nothing, so it means this is a proof in Torah that there's going to be Yemos Mashiach and there's going to be larger borders of Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, so of necessity, then this Tzibur is going to have to be fulfilled, and Yemos Mashiach, then we will in fact have the Ore Miklat in the most perfect way, where you'll have nine Ore Miklat instead of six. Why we're going to need Ore Miklat, Mimosa Mashiach, when there's not going to be any killing, is a whole other question, which is dealt with in that Sicha and in various other places. Okay. Continuing with Halachas of Tzitzis. So we talked yesterday about cutting the tzitzis strings. We talked about cutting them before you put them into the hole, after you put them in the hole, etc. But now, b'chlal, it's better not to cut the tzitzis strings with a knife or scissors or anything like that. Al derech, like you have the stones in the mizbeach, lo sanif aleihem barzel, that you shouldn't have iron touch them. So better bite them off with one's teeth. Okay. Now, let's talk about how the tzitzis are actually made. Now, the Torah says, G'dilim tasamacha, and the word G'dilim means a braid or windings. So it sounds like the whole thing should be wound. But for also wound tzitzis, on the other hand, the word tzitzis means separated strings. Earlier we learned that for that reason, you're supposed to check the string and see if they're tangled, then untangle them before you put on the talus or the talus cotton. So tzitzis implies separated strings. So what is it? Is it gdil or separated strings? So it means you have to have, first you have a gdil, a braided area, and then you have tzitzis out of that. Now, minat Torah, there's no maximum amount of gdil. So therefore, so whether you wound most of it or even one chulya, it would be kosher, as long as you make a knot at the end of it, because the windings won't stay unless you put a knot after them. So therefore, so in order for there to be a gdil, of necessity there has to be a knot after that. One thing we'll talk about in the following simonim about how many windings and how the windings are actually arranged. But one nafkamina of that is that if, for example, some of the windings have come loose, as they often do, if the knots come loose and sometimes the windings start coming off also, on Shabbos, they would still be considered valid tzitzis, and it's not carrying to wear them because, again, minat Torah, you don't have a minimum number. As long as you have some windings and a knot afterwards, then you're good. So therefore, that can be considered the minimum valid tzitzis on a minat Torah level. So now, if you wound the whole thing and didn't leave any strings hanging off, it would be possible because you don't have tzitzis, you don't have the separate strings over there. So when there was Tchelas, the Chachamim had said you should have a minimum of seven windings connected Shivur Akiyim, because Tchelas resembles the heaven, and then there should be a knot at the end of every Cholya in order to distinguish between one and the next. Nowadays we don't have Tchelas, so there doesn't specifically have to be a number of Cholyas or a number of knots. Nevertheless, the ancient minhag is to make five knots, because then we have the famous gematria of Tzitzis equaling 608 and eight strings, and five knots equaling Tariyah. So therefore, we do it like that, Lamaisa.